Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
The election isn't until November, but it's not too soon to hear from the candidates.
Yeah, we do have a right to bear arms in this country, and students also have a right to feel safe in their school.
Two vying to represent Greater Ashland in the Assembly join us for a debate.
I'm an avid sportsman. I'm a big 2A Second Amendment guy, but I would like to address the main issue, which I believe is mental health.
Plus, do you still not have broadband?
We're asking residents to tell us, do you have internet at your home?
And would you install a solar panel if the government helped pay for it? Wisconsin's Public Service Commission chief tells us of a new pot of money just for that. Those stories and a regional news and review after this.
Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
Do you still not have broadband?
We're asking residents to tell us, do you have internet at your home?
And would you install a solar panel if the government helped pay for it? Wisconsin's Public Service Commission chief tells us of a new pot of money just for that. Plus, the election isn't until November, but it's not too soon to hear from the candidates.
I'm an avid sportsman. I'm a big 2A Second Amendment guy, but I would like to address the main issue, which I believe is mental health.
Two vying to represent Greater Ashland in the Assembly join us for a debate.
Yeah, we do have a right to bear arms in this country, and students also have a right to feel safe in their school.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. It's election season already, and though the general election isn't until November, we've got a bunch of local races to pay attention to, which means we need to get started now. This week, we've invited candidates vying for the open seat in the 74th District that covers the Ashland area, Phillips, and Greater Hayward. One of them will replace incumbent Democratic Representative Beth Myers, who's retiring. On the Democratic side is John Adams. He lives outside Washburn and has served on the Washburn Town Board. He works for Bayfield Foods Cooperative as a vegetable grower and distributor and has organized a local chapter of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. As a business owner, he says he knows firsthand the value of small businesses in northern Wisconsin. On the Republican side is Chance Green of the town of Grandview. He, too, is a small business owner, as well as a former volunteer firefighter. He was the Assistant Director of Public Works in Amory and the Utilities Manager in Ashland. Both candidates will be asked the same questions and given a chance to rebut each other. With that, welcome to Simply Superior, Chance Green and John Adams.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's begin. Each of you will have a short opening statement, which was determined with the flip of a coin, and John got the flip. So we will begin with you, John Adams.
Hello. Thanks, Robin, and thanks, KUWS, for hosting this debate. I really appreciate the value of local journalism and giving people the information to make their decision on the vote. I mention that because I was a journalist in a prior life. I'm a farmer now. I grow for Bayfield Foods, a farm cooperative. But my college degree is in journalism, and I worked at several small newspapers in my formative years and then finished up at the Duluth News Tribune before I jumped into farming. So I did grow up in Duluth well. My dad worked for the railroad, and my mom was a school teacher's aide. And I moved over to this region 12 years ago and bought this farm 8 years ago. It's a 40-acre farm. Overlooks Lake Superior in the town of Washburn, and I am happy to be here. I grow for a great cooperative, and that's what I want to see more of in the state, is cooperative solutions that are helpful for our northern economy.
Thank you, John Adams. And Chance Green, your opening statement.
Hello. Thanks again for having me. Again, I'm Chance Green, running for State Assembly of 74th District. I'm a small business owner and a former municipal worker. I've worked for a municipality most of my life, but I arrived in Ashland about 3.5 years ago in 2018. One of my biggest accomplishments and something I'm very proud of is I worked with the staff at Ashland, and they had experienced sewage overflows in the bay for more than 30 years. We identified that problem. We had put a plan of attack, and I'm proud to say in the last 2.5 years, the city hasn't experienced any overflow. So that's a big feather in my hat and something I'm very proud of. Another issue that I guess I'm dealing with, but take close to heart, is people, friends and family in this area experiencing the rising costs of foods and goods and services, as well as just regular inflation. Moving forward, I'd like to be the guy to address that. I feel like I get things done. I've rolled with the punches most of my life, and I feel like once I get a hold of something, I always see it through, and I'm hoping to be your next elected official, and with your help on November 8th, I can hopefully address the rising costs and the squeeze northern Wisconsin's feeling in the pocketbook.
Thank you very much, Chance Green. And so now the questions, beginning this time with you, Chance Green. How do we keep our schools and communities safe in the wake of recent deadly school shootings? And how can this be accomplished while balancing Second Amendment rights?
Well, that's a great question. I believe that I fear for our children. I do believe that there is an issue when it comes to mental health and kids not knowing how to deal with their emotions. I think we need to address that problem by funding and putting in mental health facilities in our area. I currently have to go to Madison or further downstate to address these things or to seek help. So I'd definitely like to address that issue. And again, I'm an avid sportsman. I'm a big 2A Second Amendment guy, but I would like to address the main issue, which I believe is mental health issues and getting these kids the help that they need, as well as anybody else who has mental health issues. I think it's a big problem up here in northern Wisconsin. We have long, drawn-out winters, and I think that combating mental health issues by making sure we have all the necessary resources for that would be a big issue and definitely help resolve that problem.
Okay. Same question, and I'll repeat it for you, John. How do we keep our schools and communities safe in the wake of recent deadly school shootings, and how can this be accomplished while balancing Second Amendment rights?
Yeah, I think you mentioned in the question, you know, the importance of balancing those rights. And we do have a right to bear arms in this country, and students also have a right to feel safe in their schools. They're in those classrooms, and they are absolutely at the whim of the adults who vote and protect those schools. So we need to make sure that when people are showing signs of a mental illness, those people can be stopped before they're given access to a gun. And allowing 18-year-olds who may be mentally unstable access to AR-15s is totally unreasonable to me. When we talk about mental illness in rural areas, we're in a crisis mode. Our counties cannot afford to get enough care for these children, and the facilities are too far away. So in Price County, a year ago to this month, they sent a letter to the Wisconsin Counties Association asking for an increase in the tax levy limit. Wisconsin's been living under a tax levy limit for over a decade, and it's severely cut our local towns and counties' ability to raise money. So when these increasing costs come along, such as kids suffering from mental illness, we all just went through COVID, our kids are struggling, those costs are causing counties to lose money. And in Price County, it's a severe issue, and several other counties, I hear about it from county board members as well. So unless we're going to realistically tackle the mental illness issue in the state, then we're going to have to look at abuse with our guns. And that's the debate that needs to happen in the legislature. And we need a diversity of views on that. And I understand the issue, and I want to be the one making the debate.
Okay. Chance, any rebuttal to that?
Yeah, if I could. I guess my biggest, without raising tax or levy limits, I would think, because the state has a $3.5 billion surplus, we could definitely get some of that money back into the local municipalities and address these issues where they're having shortfalls in budgets. I think we could, that would be best using that money that we've conservatively saved up over the last decade or so. Putting it back in local municipalities so they can address these issues would be a win for everybody.
Okay. And John, final rebuttal to rebuttal?
Yeah, I'll just follow up that these state mandates are coming down on these counties and towns, and the counties and towns don't have the money to pay for it. So we need to have a better shared revenue formula, and it affects everything from the mental health to our students to the turnover rate of our teachers in the state, and it's crippling our communities.
Okay, and we will continue this time with John Adams. Enbridge's Line 5 project promises to bring economic development to the area, including 700 jobs, but is opposed by environmental groups and American Indian tribes, who say any spill will irreparably harm the Lake Superior watershed and also impede treaty rights, fishing, and ricing. How do you balance these competing concerns, or do you?
We definitely have to balance those competing concerns because we are looking at an economic issue of the value of Lake Superior and the value of fossil fuel energy. In the long term, which do we value more? And that is a very complicated issue. And as a caveat, I'll say primarily this is a federally regulated issue. In the state assembly, we primarily regulate this through the DNR and their draft environmental impact statement. And so that is where the influence comes from representatives in the assembly, through that DNR statement. And so the issue is, do we trust Enbridge to keep Lake Superior clean? And if you look at their recent history, the oil spill in Kalamazoo was catastrophic and nearly entered Lake Michigan. Now, if that heavy crude oil would have entered the lake, what was the plan to clean that up? It's not like this oil floats like traditional oil. Well, it took $500 million in 5 years in digging up the riverbed of the Kalamazoo River. And Enbridge and the EPA didn't have a plan for how to clean this up. So when we talk about installing this pipeline, I want to be sure that that environmental impact, if there is a spill, there's a plan to clean it up. And so when I asked the EPA administrator, hey, how well prepared are you for a potential oil spill like they had in Kalamazoo? She said, well, we are the best prepared district in the country for this type of spill. I wasn't reassured by that answer. We need a stiff DEIS from our DNR to make sure we can protect Lake Superior. That's the reason we live here. The lifeblood of our economy. It's the lifeblood of a lot of people who live here. It's what I rely on for clean water, and it's what we all rely on for clean water. So this is a very big issue. It's super complicated, and I want to make sure that we keep the lake safe.
Okay. Chance, same question, which I will repeat. Enbridge's Line 5 project promises to bring economic development to the area, including 700 jobs, but is opposed by environmental groups and American Indian tribes who say that any spill will irreparably harm the Lake Superior watershed, which would also impede treaty rights, fishing, and ricing. How do you balance these competing concerns, or do you?
That's a good question. So I am in support of Line 5. I think it'll be great for our local economies and things. I think that with all the job creation and the money brought to crews coming into the area, staying for lodging, eating out, I think it'll be a big boom for our area. But I want to hold them accountable. We expect nothing but the highest standard in all efficiencies. They need to make sure that they're following the rules, that they're protecting our environment. Like John said, Lake Superior is our number one priority. I personally have made Lake Superior a number one priority in cleaning it up, and I want to make sure that they can not only promise that they keep any spills or anything out of Lake Superior, but that they're held responsible in case anything does happen. Like I say, I think it'd be a great boost for our economy, our local economies, and a great opportunity for Northern Wisconsin, but they need to make sure, we need to make sure we have all our ducks in a row, and we need to make sure that that they're held to a high standard. But I welcome the project in our area.
John Adams, any rebuttal?
Yeah, I think we both recognize the importance of keeping the lake clean. And recent history tells a different story about Enbridge's commitment to safety of the lake. And so The important thing is that the DNR goes over that BEIS with a fine-tooth comb and recognizes how much the tribes and how much everyone else living up here values the lake. It's not like we're building this pipeline through Iowa. It's a clay plain on Lake Superior. It's very susceptible to oil spills and runoffs. So I think that's the important thing to keep in focus.
And Chance, any response to that?
Yes, like I say, as long as we're, I think, we need to encourage the DNR to hold these guys to a higher standard. With the greatest lake in the world, literally at our doorstep, we need to make sure we're protecting it. And I would like to see that they are held to that higher standard. We need to make sure they have all their precautionary plans, emergency plans, response plans, everything in order. So if there is a spill or anything like that happens, that they are quickly to respond and take care of it so it doesn't affect the lake. And like I say, I think we just need to make sure that we hold them accountable and make sure we hold them to that higher standard.
All right. And the next one, this one again, beginning with Chance. With this reversal in Roe versus Wade, the United States Supreme Court returned the abortion issue to the states. What role do you think the Wisconsin legislature should have regarding abortion, especially given our area's proximity to Minnesota, where it remains legal?
Gotcha. That's a great question. So I personally am pro-life. I believe that life begins at conception, but I am open and willing to listen to all exceptions, such as mother's life, rape and incest clauses, things like that. I do believe that we should be open and susceptible to that. Moving forward, I do believe that that it was the right decision to bring the decision back to the state. It empowers the people to decide. By electing officials and things like that. And then moving forward, I'd definitely be open to, again, hearing clauses and clearing up a very old law that I believe it's the 1840 law that we currently follow. I'd like to clean that up, clarify, make it clear on what the rules are and what the rules aren't when it comes to an abortion and move forward with that.
Okay. The same question to you, John. With this reversal in Roe versus Wade, the United States Supreme Court returned the abortion issue to the states. What role do you think the Wisconsin legislature should have regarding abortion, especially given our area's proximity to Minnesota, where it remains legal?
Yeah, well, I think the Republicans have pretty clearly stated that they're going to want to keep that 1849 ban in place with no exceptions for rape or incest. And to me, this gets to why I'm a Democrat. The Democrats are the party of freedom, and you can't take rights away in this country and not feel the pain come November. So we're starting to Rovember because people are going to remember what the Republicans did when they took away a right for families to plan when they want to have children. So what does an 1849 ban look like across the country? You're seeing that when women are coming into emergency rooms, they're bleeding, they're pregnant, and the doctor who wants to prescribe an abortion doesn't know what to do because they don't want to get thrown in jail for up to 99 years like in the state of Texas. Roe v. Wade was fundamentally about a right to privacy between a patient and their doctor. And that is an ideal that comes straight out of what I call Northern values. It's a live and let live mentality, and it's a freedom mentality. And it's a dependence on your community around you. And so I think this, like Trump said, and I will rarely agree with that man, but he said, I think the Republicans made a big mistake when they did that, and they're going to feel it in November. And I totally agree with him. You just can't take the right away from Americans that they've lived with for 50 years.
Okay. Jess Green, response to that?
Yes. Oh, like I say, my biggest event is life begins at conception. I believe that that is a small life, and I am for fighting for that life. That is my biggest issue when it comes to abortion. Again, I understand there's exceptions, and with the 1849 law, it's very vague. At this time, it leaves it open to interpretation when it comes to whether or not an abortion is appropriate and things like that, and atopical pregnancies and things, but those are considered non-abortion issues. Those are considered for health and safety issues for the mother. But again, that's why I believe we need to clean that up. I think we need to update it. I think we need to clean it up, make sure that everybody knows the rules and where we stand. And another big thing when it comes to abortion is I'm not, you know, with that being said, bringing life to conception, we need to make sure that we're supporting mothers in this issue too. So I would like to see that we fund and make sure that we're providing options for young mothers who weren't expecting to start a family, but we can make sure they can move forward and have the things that they need to make sure that child has a long and prosperous life.
Okay. And finally, John Adams, any rebuttal to that?
Yeah, I'll just say that the Republicans could have convened the legislature to debate the merits of that 1849 law, but they refused to do so, and they haven't met since the first week of March. So full-time legislators not reconvening until after the election. And there's issues like this that are super important to the state, super important to our region, and super important to women's lives. So I don't believe that Republicans are actually valuing this decision.
Okay, and moving on, this one beginning with you, John. Despite multiple government audits that showed no evidence of fraud in the 2020 elections, some Wisconsin voters still have concerns about election integrity. How would you address those concerns and restore faith in the voting process for those voters?
Well, I think that the state has invested heavily in voter security, and that's why the voter fraud claims that are loudly pushed by partisans on a national stage are not simply true. And my opponent actually inquired with the county agent in charge of elections in Bayfield County, and he verified that fact as well, that there is no voter fraud, especially locally. And the results of the Michael Gableman investigation with $1.3 million in taxpayer-funded money shortly before he got fired were, well, there is no voter fraud. So to say that we need to persuade people of voting integrity, I just say, first, tell me the evidence of that, because all the evidence has shown that there is no voter fraud. And if there is, it's a 0.001%. It's the most secure voting in the world. So the question is, then what is this argument about? And primarily it's about voter suppression and causing people to lose faith in the elections so they don't vote. And that goes against freedom. That goes against our rights in this country. And I stand absolutely against that.
Okay. Chance Green, same question. Despite multiple government audits that show no evidence of fraud in the 2020 elections, some Wisconsin voters still have concerns about election integrity. How would you address those concerns and restore faith in the voting process for those voters?
Gotcha. Well, I won't lie. My first concern when it comes to election integrity is the fact that two separate parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, can read election-related statute and come away with different interpretations. I think that's our biggest problem. I think we need to clean up. Our election laws are vague. And whether you agree or not that Democrats exploited that is null or void. We need to move forward and actually clarify those laws. We need to clean them up. We need to make sure that everyone knows this is right, this is wrong, you can do this, you can't do that, and we move forward and then educate people on how elections work. I had a great conversation with the former county clerk at Bayfield, and he assured me that a lot of issues when it comes to have to go through him. And it's not the little old ladies at the polling place. We trust these people. We live with these people. They're not tampering with anything. So the process, I just don't think people quite understand the process. So I think we need to clarify our laws. We need to educate people on how elections work. And we need to ensure moving forward that they can not only trust in the election process, but they can also, they have faith and they can know that their vote is count. It counts and it matters. And that it's the biggest thing. It's one of our greatest privileges and rights as Americans to vote. So I want to make sure that everybody is well educated in it and can trust it and have faith in our election, Wisconsin elections.
Okay. John Adams, any rebuttal?
I totally agree. And I like that on the Democratic brochure, you see a voter helpline, and it's a phone number, and it's staff person, nonpartisan information on how to vote. And that goes on every one of the Democrats' brochures. They want more people to vote. And I just don't think the Republican Party is in that same league. As much as I hate to quote Donald Trump, but as of today, he says he wants to be installed as the 2020 president. So voter education is great, but on a landscape of national rhetoric like that, it becomes a lot more serious about influencing people's opinions on the security of the vote. And this is about the security of democracy. When democracy is being questioned without evidence, that's a much more serious thing than just educating people about how to vote.
Okay. Chance Green, final rebuttal to rebuttal.
Yes. So I can't control what the people are doing on a national level or a federal level, but the message I'm trying to convey in the 74th district, where I hope to have a say, where I can affect, where I can be a positive light, where people can reach out and ask me questions. That's what I'm trying to control, and that's the message I want to have up here. You know, we're gonna educate people. We're gonna move forward with elections. We're going to clean up our laws. We're going to make sure everybody knows the rules and knows how to play the game. And we're going to move forward and we're going to have a better understanding and we can trust our election process.
Okay. And lastly, and this one will begin with Chance Green. Many, if not most voters, are frustrated by gridlock and political parties refusing to work with one another. What's a cause dear to your opponent's party that you would be willing to embrace?
Well, that's a good question. I know as Democrats up here, I've met quite a few on the campaign trail. I know a lot of issues affecting all of us as Northern Wisconsin. So a lot of them, like environmental things like that, all relatable. I believe going forward, I would have to discuss it with colleagues. How to, on the Democratic side, I'd have to meet with those guys and see what issues are important to them and see how we can address and fix them. I'm willing to do that. I've done that in the past. I've worked with people in the past that have both been Democratic and Republican without issue. We've addressed problems. We've identified them and we put a plan of attack in. We've gotten results. We've gotten things done, especially when I moved to Ashland. That was, there were a lot of people that disagreed with how we disagreed on politics, but we were able to work together wonderfully. I consider a lot of these people my friends. We found the problem, we identified how to fix it, and we implemented a plan of attack. I feel that I can reach across the aisle, work well with others. I've always worked well with others, and I look forward to working well with everybody in the house when I get down to Madison.
All right. And John Adams, same question. Many, if not most, voters are frustrated by gridlock and political parties refusing to work with one another. What's a cause dear to your opponent's party that you would be willing to embrace?
Yeah, I'll give you a specific example. Actually, there's a community solar bill introduced by Republican Dewey Strobel. And that is something that is held up in the legislature. And community solar is incredibly popular around the country. 35 states have legalized it. And in Wisconsin, it's held up by some Republican backers and utility companies. And then it's held up on the Democratic side by unions who fear that these community solar installations aren't going to be union installed. So at the legislature, somebody needs to be able to negotiate with both of those sides so Wisconsin can catch up to the rest of the country. Minnesota is currently leading the country in these community installations. And what does that mean? That means we could control our own local power and we can invest in these community solar installations and reduce the price of energy, reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. And it's just a common sense solution most of the country is doing. But right now, the gridlock in the legislature isn't allowing that bill to get anywhere. So we need to move into solar power. We need to do it with union jobs, and we need to bring that
local sovereignty back to our region so our local communities can invest in their own power. And that's something I would love to work on with Republicans.
All right. Chance Green, rebuttal to that?
No, not at this time. No.
Okay. That is a wonderful way to end it. Not that we're taking anything away from you. But again, since the question was about working across the aisles, I'll give you this much of my opinion. I think you both answered it quite well. And with that, we've been speaking with Chance Green of Grandview and with John Adams of Washburn. They're candidates for the 74th district seat in the Wisconsin Assembly in November. Thank you for joining us, Chance and John.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks, John. Thank you guys for your time.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Coming up, can the Federal Inflation Reduction Act finally bring broadband to rural Wisconsin? After this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Have you thought about trying to cut your electric bill by installing solar panels on your house? And have you tried to shop for them on the internet only to find out it's too slow? Because broadband hasn't come to your area yet, and what they're calling broadband just doesn't have enough bandwidth to shop for anything. Well, new programs from the federal government earmarked for areas such as rural Wisconsin are poised to address both of those issues with the passage of the Federal Inflation Reduction Act. The recently passed legislation brings billions of dollars to the states to be used in part for clean energy projects such as those solar panels or more efficient appliances for your home, as well as money to finally wire up rural areas where the internet currently barely exists. One of the people in charge of administering those programs is Rebecca Volk, the chairperson of the State Public Service Commission. She visited Superior the other day and spoke with my WPR colleague, Danielle Kading, who asked her what's been the hang-up in accomplishing these efforts, such as maps showing who exactly has broadband and who doesn't, and when the money will come to jumpstart the programs. Here's their conversation.
What do you Wisconsinites stand to gain through energy efficiency or renewable energy measures under the Inflation Reduction Act?
So under the Inflation Reduction Act, our estimate is that homeowners in Wisconsin will be able to save about 21.6% on their utility bills, which on average is about $651 per year. And that's because the Inflation Reduction Act is going to make it more affordable for Wisconsin families to purchase energy efficient appliances. It's going to make it more affordable to install solar rooftop panels. It's going to make it more affordable for battery storage to be incorporated at houses. And it's also going to help local and state governments adopt the latest building energy codes. And those codes are really what's going to drive the bulk of the savings for customers on their utility bills. So our estimate is that over 90,000 additional Wisconsin households will install rooftop panels as a result of the tax credits from the Inflation Reduction Act. And those tax credits will cover 30% of the costs to install solar panels and battery storage. And so those rebates will make repairs and improvements in single-family and multifamily homes really, really accessible.
And how much could people receive as far as a rebate under that?
So rebates are covering 50 to 100% of the cost of installing new electric appliances, so beneficial electrification, things like super efficient heat pumps, water heaters, clothes dryers, stoves, ovens, and then tax credits covering 30% of the costs to install solar panels and battery storage systems, and no income limits apply to those tax credits.
Anything that you wanted to add about energy efficiency before moving on to broadband?
No, I mean, I just think that it's a very historic piece of legislation and the recognition of the important role energy efficiency plays is just a welcome sight. And I hope that Wisconsin residents avail themselves of all of these opportunities.
Well, on the broadband internet expansion, hundreds of millions of dollars have been delivered by the federal government through COVID-19 relief packages. Tell me about the federal funding Wisconsin has or is set to receive, and has all of that money been awarded?
So far, we have awarded nearly $300 million in projects to bring expanded or improved service to over 387,000 Wisconsin homes and businesses. So that is an accomplishment that I think bears noting and repeating, that we have really doubled down on our efforts to ensure that Wisconsin residents are connected. But we know that there is a lot of additional work. We expect Wisconsin will be able to receive anywhere between $700 million and maybe perhaps a bit over $1 billion in federal funding.
Is that altogether the funding that Wisconsin has received, or is this new funding that would come from the infrastructure law?
Yes, this is new funding. So this is new funding that would come from the bipartisan infrastructure law. And so we anticipate that we will learn what our allocation is likely in 2023.
And so as part of this federal funding from the infrastructure law, you said it is about unserved and underserved areas, and I know that the state has a different estimate than the FCC to determine who has access and who doesn't. And so how are you going to be moving forward to ensure that people who aren't connected or are underconnected will be served?
We seek information voluntarily from internet service providers. We also issued the WISER, which is the Wisconsin Internet Self-Reporting Survey, so that we're asking residents to tell us, do you have internet at your home? What we're attempting to do is to crowdsource the data to ensure that what we get back from the FCC is accurate. And if it's not, that we have the proper data to then go back and say, no, you're showing this particular region as being served, but we have verified that there is no service there. So this is how many residents and businesses are still unserved in that area.
Well, and my understanding is that Wisconsin has already received around $1.5 billion in federal funding. And so, you know, I think some people would look at that and say, well, that's a lot of money. Why aren't we connected yet?
Yes, these numbers sound like really large numbers. I think what's more important to look at is the dollars that we have administered through the state broadband expansion grant, whether those were federal dollars or state dollars that came from the state budget, and look at actually how many locations have been served. What we know and what we continue to learn is that because of the inaccuracy of the coverage maps, when we started out and we thought, okay, we have about 400,000 unserved locations in Wisconsin, as you go through each iterative process and you put new projects in place and you're deploying additional dollars, that's when you get additional data that says, no, we actually don't have it here. So we are refining our estimates of who is unserved and underserved. So sometimes it feels as though, well, we're spending all of this money, but we're not making progress because the numbers keep changing. That's true, but that doesn't make it any less important or less urgent to get everybody who's unserved to get them service, right? I mean, and we should be striving for as accurate information as we can possibly get. To be quite honest, it's probably going to take another $1 billion to get everybody in the state of Wisconsin connected where they need to be. So that means that some of those dollars are going to have to be deployed to bring service up from where it currently sits. because really that's the goal. The goal is to ensure that people have access to broadband that is sufficient enough to allow them to participate in daily life. So it's really all about data. And we talk at the Public Service Commission about data before deployment. It's really important that we have precise information on who is served, who's unserved, and who is underserved before we decide where the grant dollars are going to be allocated.
How soon could we see that money flowing into Wisconsin?
We anticipate that the first round of the maps will be out this fall from the FCC. That's going to then start the process in earnest. That's when we will look at the data, we will look at the map, and then we'll know how much money is allocated to Wisconsin at the first part of 2023. When we talk about broadband deployment and when we talk about the clean energy transition, we have to be really careful that we bring everybody along, that nobody gets left behind, because everybody has and deserves the right to access high-speed internet at an affordable price, because the world is digital.
Thank you very much for talking about these topics with us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be in Superior.
That was my WPR colleague Danielle Kading speaking with Rebecca Volk, the chairperson of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission, about how the Federal Inflation Reduction Act may help you bring more energy efficiency to your home and broadband to rural areas. Regarding that last point, if you're listening to this program through a broadband internet connection, I'd like to say, just kidding. There's nothing wrong with your connection or your good old-fashioned radio. Coming up, the regional news and review after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Rick Lubbers, the executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Danielle Kading of WPR News. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Rick, we've had a few conversations with John Coe of CHUM, the area's largest homeless shelter, about impromptu or unofficial shelters that have sprung up, including under a bridge in Superior. The city of Duluth has adopted a new policy toward them.
Yes, it has. Homeless people soon could have an outdoor living space to temporarily call home. The Duluth City Council voted Monday night to offer an interim use permit authorizing local nonprofits to operate outdoor living areas where displaced people can set up camp on a seasonal basis. Joel Kilgore, an organizer for a local initiative to address homelessness, said the group hopes to establish up to 4 outdoor living areas, each housing no more than a dozen people, on private land and likely in partnership with Duluth faith congregations. The effort to provide temporary relief to people experiencing homelessness has been dubbed Stepping On Up. And Kilgore said the outdoor living spaces are a recognition of unauthorized homeless encampments that often spring up across the city. Often city officials are called in to break up these makeshift shelters and are saddled with the cost of cleaning up after them. By creating alternative safer sites with amenities such as restrooms, water, garbage disposal, sharps containers, and access to support services, the city expects it can reduce the amount it spends dealing with the fallout from homeless encampments. The city is prepared to offer 1-year permits to nonprofits willing to set up and supervise outdoor living spaces for homeless people. Duluth has also set aside $150,000 in federal American Rescue Act funds to help provide needed infrastructure to support the outdoor living spaces. So far, though, no entity has yet applied for a permit, but Kilgore remains confident Duluth will rise to the challenge. He explained that the outdoor living spaces would likely operate for no more than 3 years, until such time as more adequate temporary indoor housing can be built and then ultimately replaced with more permanent private living quarters with shared communal spaces. Kilgore said, "This is experimental for all of us. A lot of other communities have tried this out, and we're learning the best we can from them." While no one has an exact count on how many people are currently homeless in Duluth, Kilgore said that number is clearly in the hundreds and far exceeds the capacity for local shelters. He said the outdoor living areas would close during winter months when such a shelter would be neither adequate or safe.
All right. Well, we noted recently that there's a lot of music concerts now that the pandemic has subsided a bit, or people just want to go out. And there's a really big one at Bayfront this weekend.
Yes, there is. The organization Honor the Earth has been holding concerts to raise funds and awareness since its founding nearly three decades ago. The last year's event in Bayfront Festival Park drew national attention due to the participation of headliner Bon Iver and the impending completion of Enbridge's Line 3 replacement through Minnesota. This year, organizers are hoping to build on that momentum with another high-profile lineup, including Annie DeFranco, Indigo Girls, Dessa, Tia Wood, Galen Lee, Allison Russell, Anne Humphrey, and Joe Rainey Sr. The Sunday festival will also mark Lowe's first performance since canceling a string of European shows while founding member Minnie Parker undergoes cancer treatment. Winona LaDuke, who co-founded Honor the Earth with Indigo Girls in 1993, will again host.
All right. Well, those names need no introduction. And Galen Lee, being one of them, will be joining us on the show in a couple of weeks. The Duluth School District has kicked off the year with a new program designed, I think, to bring everyone together.
Yes, it has. As a new school year approaches, a Duluth back-to-school event sought to bridge the city's east-west divide. Duluth Public School administrators hosted the inaugural Unity in Our Community get-together on Monday at Bayfront Festival Park. The festivities included a DJ, bouncy house, backpack giveaways, free haircuts and braids, free lunches, and a COVID-19 vaccine clinic. And there were performances by the Denfield High School Jazz Rhythm Section and the School of Minnesota Ballet. Attendees also had the opportunity to soak Superintendent John Magus in a dunk tank or munch on barbecue grilled by Assistant Superintendent Anthony Bonds. Magus said that we have many schools, but we're one school district. It's all about celebrating coming back and being together. Several regional and district organizations participated as well, including the Great Lakes Aquarium, the Duluth Children's Museum, and the district's Educational Equality Office and high school robotics teams. About 1,000 people took part in the event. The first day of classes for Duluth Public Schools in grades 1 through 12 is Tuesday, September 6th, and for kindergartners is Thursday, September 8th.
All right. Well, Danny, the Superior School District also has a new program, this one related to student safety. It comes on the heels of contention over the gender identity curriculum, which was ultimately approved by the district last week. What's the new program?
So the program was actually something that was in the works prior to that decision. And under the program, law enforcement will notify school officials at the Superior School District when they've responded to an emergency involving a student or the student's family. And the program is called Handle with Care. And under it, police agencies send notice to school administrators, counselors, or social workers to let them know when a student has had contact with law enforcement. And those encounters may involve a domestic dispute, a mental health crisis, a fire, or some other event that, you know, could affect the student when they return to school. And law enforcement doesn't share specific details of any incident. Superior School District Administrator Amy Starzecki said the goal is to provide grace to students who may be overly tired or irritable or withdrawn and struggling to focus on school when these types of situations arise. And so the district worked with the Superior Police Department and Douglas County Sheriff's Office over the summer on a plan for the school year. And as part of it, police will notify her office of any encounters, and then the student's counselor and principal will be made aware to handle that student with care. Starzecki said she's worked with the program before in Duluth schools. Other schools in Wisconsin have also been using this program, including the La Crosse District.
All right. And speaking of kids, and I'm not talking about school kids, the other kind, do I hear goats?
Yeah, no kidding, Robin. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is now using goats to control invasive plants for the first time on the Brule River State Forest. The agency is partnering on the $7,500 project with Jake Reno Williams and his wife Bridget in Poplar. They own Regenerative Ruminants, and they've been bringing in a herd of roughly 30 to 35 goats to graze on buckthorn across roughly 5 acres there. And the DNR's forest manager, Dan Kephart, says the forest has had a problem with buckthorn for a long time. The woody invasive shrub can crowd out other native trees to the forest, like white pine, ash, and balsam. And so the DNR has used herbicides and mowing in the past to control buckthorn, but this year is the first time that they've used goats, and they're pretty good at eating everything within reach, according to their owners. The DNR will bring the goats back again next spring, and then they'll evaluate the site over time to determine whether they're most effective at reducing invasive species there. And it's not the first time that the DNR has used goats to control invasive species. The agency has also used goats on state properties like Governor Knowles State Forest.
All right. Well, all kidding aside, we've been speaking with Danielle Kading, Superior Base reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
And Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. On next week's show, we'll join Shane Nelson, one of our frequent musical guests, to remember Zach Ross, the longtime drummer in his group Crescent Moon, who was lost at age 28 in a car accident a little over a month ago. Here's a bit of their music. I'm Robin Washington. Please stay safe, everyone.